surprise, light streamed from under the door, the faintly greenish glow of the fluorescent coil on the ceiling. She hesitated for a moment. What if Benito was there? The idea that this would keep her from her own kitchen gave her a righteous surge of adrenaline. She swung through the door, grim-faced and prepared for battle, but was met with the sight of Martin sitting at the table, reading.
"Tante Marianne," he said, his expression guilty.
His face shifted as he took in her countenance.
"Dear Martin, poor Martin, sweet boy."
Marianne tried to smile and amend whatever anger he had seen.
"What are you doing up at this hour?" she asked. "You have school tomorrow."
"I couldn't sleep," he said simply. And it occurred to her that for him this was not an unusual occurrence.
"Have you had milk? Warm milk?"
She padded over to the small icebox and removed the bottle.
"That always helps."
He shook his head. Marianne poured enough for them both and set the saucepan on the stove.
"What are you reading?"
"Carl May." Martin held up the book. It was Marianne's own ancient copy of Winnetou. Its cracked leather binding and faded gold embossing as familiar to her as an old friend.
"I borrowed it from Fritz." "Do you like it?" Marianne asked.
"I love it." Marianne felt a swell of love for him. He was more like her than her own son, who had pronounced the book unrealistic and dull.
"It was my favorite," she said.
They were silent. The milk simmered on the stove, and the light ticked overhead.
"You're happy here, aren't you, Martin?"
Marianne asked.
"I mean, living with us, all together, you and your mother and my family."
"Of course." The boy looked surprised.
"You don't wish..."
She turned off the milk, placed two cups and saucers on the counter.
"That your mother were remarried, that you lived somewhere else with a stepfather?"
Confusion crowded across his young face. For a moment, Marianne regretted the question.
"No," he said. "Why? Do you think my mother and I should be on our own?"
"Oh, no. No, no,"
Marianne exclaimed, nearly scalding herself.
"Certainly not. I just wondered how you felt about it."
She studied his already shockingly handsome face. He looked away from the intensity of her gaze.
"Martin," she said seriously, "you know your father would have wanted it this way."
When Marianne awoke some hours later, she was hungry and filled with a sense of resolve. It was nearly 8 a.m. Fritz and Martin had already left for school. Benita was sitting stiffly at the parlor table, making one of those hideous stuffed dolls that had become her hobby of late. When Marianne entered, she looked up and her face was pale, her eyes swollen from crying.
"Marianne," she began, "I'm sorry I never told you before. I couldn't sleep. I..."
"Never mind," Marianne cut her off.
"I cannot give you my blessing to marry Herr Müller," she continued. "I have thought about it, and it is not right."
Benita regarded her with a plaintive face.
"Why?" "Because he was a Nazi. But everyone was a Nazi. He is a good man. Because it isn't right that you should marry someone who worked for everything your husband died fighting against."
Marianne could hear her own shrillness. Benita began to cry. She looked childish and delicate in her distress. It made Marianne feel old. Here she was, cast again as the unstable, unemotional foil to Benita's damsel in distress.
"Do you even know what he did in the war?" Marianne asked. "Do you talk about it?"
Benita wiped her eyes.
"I don't know, and I don't care. He was in the Orpo, You know that much, don't you? She demanded. But do you know what they did there, in the east?
Hastily, Benita rose and moved to the window. When she turned again, her face was illuminated by a new desperation.
Don't you ever want to put it away, Marianne? To be done with it? I don't want to know what they did. I don't want to look over my shoulder forever. It was a horrible time, and now it is past.
Marianne stared at her. It was so selfish and cowardly. It made her blood boil. Benita was always looking out for her own interest, her own comfort.
You think the past is like one of your dolls, that you can just tear it up and begin over again, like that. And you are the wife of a hero, a man who died to make the past a little less horrible than it is. Don't you think you owe him at least a little respect?
Now Benita began to cry in earnest. Her shoulders shook, and ugly, sputtering sobs escaped from her throat.
Do what you want,
Marianne sighed.
But I won't let you draw Martin into this.
At this, Benita looked up. She reached into her pocket for a handkerchief and blew her nose.
Think it through,
Marianne said, softening slightly.
It is easy to mistake.
Benita interrupted.
You are cruel, Marianne. Connie always said so, but I never saw it.
She looked directly at her.
But now I can see it.
All day, Marianne felt the words like an ache. When would Connie have said this? It was a betrayal. Tough, she could imagine him saying. Discerning, even hard. But not cruel. It was an arrow to her heart.
Katerina?
She asked when the girl came to say goodnight.
Do you think of me as cruel?
Katerina's dark eyes blinked in surprise. It was not like her mother to ask such a thing.
Cruel?
She repeated. The word shocked her. She was a true von Lingenfels.
Of course not. Why do you ask?
Marianne sighed.
Maybe we are all cruel sometimes without intending to be. Not you,
Katerina said, with such earnestness it made Marianne smile.
Even me.
Marianne put an arm around her daughter and rested her cheek against the girl's side. Despite everything, she was still only a child. Marianne longed for the reassuring voice of an adult. She would ask Anya when she saw her next. Chapter 20. Erlenheim, June 1950. Anya received another letter the following Saturday. This time it was not delivered by the mailman, but by Frau Metzger, the woman who brought their cheese.
From a man?
Frau Metzger said with a coquettish smile, pulling the crinkly envelope from her bag.
It came to the market last week.
Anya stared.
Well?
Frau Metzger grinned.
Aren't you going to open it?
Or maybe you already know who it was.
The woman winked.
Of course not,
Anya said.
Ah.
Frau Metzger sighed, obviously disappointed.
He did not look well. Recently back from the east.
Anya frowned in approximation of confusion.
Thank you very much.
This time there was no return address.
I forgive you. You did what you felt was best. But you are not finished with me yet.
The letter, if it could be called that, was wrapped around a photograph. A young man and woman wearing formal clothing, standing side by side at the bottom of an imposing set of steps. Wind blew at their hair and lifted the woman's skirt. The man gazed off to the side, as the woman smiled bravely in a manner that was as openly uncertain as it was direct. and Anya was there. With the wind blowing in her ears and her best shoes pinching her toes, and a sense of great import leading her irrationally toward giddiness. She was like a person jumping from an airplane, experiencing the lightness of commitment to an unchangeable path. It was like remembering a character from one of the novels she had read in her youth. Anya set down the photograph. Outside, the afternoon sun yellowed, and bits of dried linden blew in the wind. It was time to prepare Karsten's coffee and send Wolfgang out to the field with it. In the pasture, the bereaved mother cows bellowed for their babies still. They were not finished mourning yet. The next day, Anya visited the return address from the first letter. The trip required a bus, a train, and a long walk. Anya left Inga, the house apprentice, in charge of supper, afternoon coffee, the wash, the cucumber pickling, and tending the garden, and set off. It was an uncomfortable journey for a woman 6 months pregnant. On account of the heat, her swollen feet, and the sharp pain that shot up her spine, Anya had little time to think en route. So when she arrived in front of 19 Mauerstrasse, she was filled with a sense of shock. It was a real place, with real windows and a real door. There was a front bell and a list of names beside it. A rooming house. The neighborhood was shabby. It stank of urine and cabbage soup. An older man emerged from the door of the building as she stood there. Not Rainer, but certainly someone who had fallen on hard times. He scowled at her with blind resentment.
"Nah," he said rudely. "Does it look good enough for you?"
It took her a second to realize that he mistook her for someone looking for a place to stay. Anya squared her shoulders and mounted the steps. A hard-looking old woman came to the door.
"No children allowed here,"
she said, looking pointedly at Anya's belly.
"No, no, I'm not looking to stay," Anya said. "I'm looking for someone..."
The woman's frown deepened. She had small, scrutinizing eyes.
"I'm not an information service," she snapped.
"I'm looking for a man..."
Anya withdrew the envelope with the return address and showed it to her.
"This is a personal matter," the woman said.
Anya colored.
"It's not..."
she began and broke off. What did it matter?
"Personal, yes," Anya said. "Rainer Brandt."
The woman's eyes glanced briefly at the name without recognition. Rainer had always been the sort to slide by unnoticed, a man with an unremarkable manner and face. The woman shrugged.
"There is no one by that name here anymore."
"Did he leave a forwarding address?"
Anya asked. The woman cocked her head to the side.
"What would I do with that?" she asked. "Go on."
She shook her head, and her voice softened slightly.
"Finding him won't be worth much."
So Anya was forced to wait for Rainer to show himself. She went about her daily life half-present, botching her usual tasks. She cut herself pitting cherries, burned the potatoes she was boiling, left a pail of milk to sour in the barn.
"Are you all right?"
Inga asked.
"Just wait until you are this pregnant," Anya replied,
more harshly than she intended. It was a convenient excuse. The weeks passed, and with each one she grew more irritable. Daily she was tempted to confide in Anselm and Wolfgang, and then stopped herself. Anselm was locked in his studies, and Wolfgang spent his days with Karsten, preparing for the harvest, feeding the livestock. Karsten himself noticed nothing. He treated her with embarrassed caution, darting glances rather than direct looks her way. During their half hour after supper, he made a great show of turning on the radio for her, helping her to her chair. It would have driven her crazy if she weren't so distracted. As it was, she barely registered his ministrations. and she saw Rainer everywhere. Outside the bakery, driving Herr Daimler's gleaming new combine harvester, walking up the road from town. Every time the dog barked, Anya was certain it was him. What would she do and say when he arrived? She had a million thoughts, and none. She could see his hard, slight body, and the jerky way he looked over his shoulder, the firm set of his mouth when he embarked on unpleasant tasks. He was a body washed up in her mind, dragging the tangle of her own bad choices like so much kelp. One day, Marianne came to visit with a basket of fine rolls from Bemelmann's. It was still strange to receive her as Frau Kellermann, farm mistress rather than tenant. Anya was embarrassed at the disorder of the kitchen and her own rumpled dress. As she looked at her familiar friend's face, she was oppressed by her own secrets. Dear, difficult Marianne, who had been so generous and optimistic from the start. She had taken in Anya and her boys without hesitation, without question, and never looked back. This blessing had turned into a burden. At any moment it would blow up in Anya's face. Awkwardness made Anya formal. She pulled out Karsten's precious supply of tinned cookies and arranged them prettily on a plate.
"Don't make me feel a visitor," Marianne said, waving them away. She seemed distracted herself. "I have to ask you something," she blurted, and Anya's heart raced. "Have you ever known me to be cruel?"
Anya almost laughed.
"Never."
Marianne sighed.
"Why do you ask?"
Marianne turned from the window she had been staring out.
"Did you know Benita stayed in touch with Herr Müller? His prisoner. Do you remember him?"
Herr Müller. In Anya's mind, an image presented itself. A tall man, square-jawed, pale-eyed. She saw him as he had been the morning of the Russians, carrying Benita, a man with a guarded, uncertain face, a fellow keeper of secrets. Marianne waited.
"I remember him. Why?"
she asked, glancing out the window. The barnyard was empty. Her constant checking had become a nervous tick.
"Apparently she has been seeing him. All this time. Writing letters and visiting. He lives nearby, in Mommsen. And she imagines she loves him."
Marianne stopped.
"I never even heard a word about it. All this time."
Anya poured a cup of coffee and set it before Marianne. She was surprised, but not shocked. She had wondered whether there was something between them at the time. But she had not imagined that their affair would have continued from that life into this. Benita, unlike the prisoner, was no keeper of secrets.
"When did she tell you this?" she asked. "Just this week. As if I would be happy."
Marianne stared down into her coffee and then up at Anya.
"She never told you, either."
Anya shook her head.
"All this time she was lying."
Anya hesitated.
"She didn't lie," she said. "She just didn't share the truth with us."
Marianne frowned.
"She concealed what she was doing. What's the difference?"
Anya busied herself with drying dishes, feigning nonchalance.
"It could be like a photograph with the faces blacked out. What you see is true, it's just incomplete." "But who are people without their faces?"
Marianne was impatient.
"How could you know a man if you can't see his face?"
When Rainer finally came, it was mid-July, and the weather was hot. Anya sat in the shade under the chestnut tree, shelling peas. Sweat dripped down her sides and made her thighs sticky. Heat rose from the limestone of the barnyard in slippery, distorting waves. He was halfway across before Anya saw him. She had imagined this moment so many times that the reality was strangely flat. A single burst of adrenaline shot through her, followed by something like relief. It was clear that he was unwell. He was thinner than ever and walked with a limp. His face was waxy, and there were dark hollows beneath his eyes. His breathing was labored. At about 4 meters away, he stopped. Staring at him, Anya saw a stranger. Not someone she loved, not someone she hated. Just someone she no longer knew. It was frightening, but uncomplicated. For a long time, neither of them spoke. There was the sound of his breathing, the buzz of bees in the branches, and the mild rustle of leaves. Reiner stared at her round belly. She placed a hand over it. "What do you want?" she asked. Removing a dirty cloth from the pocket of his even dirtier jacket, much too hot for this weather, Reiner wiped his forehead and squeezed his eyes shut. He looked like a man who needed to lie down. He looked like a man who was dying. And suddenly, after all the time she had spent dreading this moment, Anya knew what to do. He opened his eyes again and regarded her. "Am I speaking to Anya Kellerman or Anya Brandt?"
Chapter 21. Mommsen, July 1950. Before Benita awoke, Marianne rose and took the train to Mommsen to see Franz Müller. No matter how many times she made this trip, the landscape remained foreign. The craggy mountains and flat green valleys dotted with cows. The patches of woods and hay huts were like something out of a fairy tale. Complex, shadowy, and intricate. So unlike the wide-open farmland of Weislau. How she still missed it. Nothing could hide on the flat plain of northern Silesia. Armies, visitors, weather, all were apparent from kilometers away. And Marianne felt at home with this transparence. For a brief stretch, the Isar River ran alongside the tracks. It came down from the high mountains, fast and pale, full of some mineral that turned it a livid, almost unnatural whitish green. To Marianne, it reeked of menace. The ashes of Ribbentrop, Keitel, and Frick, those architects of Nazi horror, had been scattered along its banks. By whose decision? The random assignment of some government automaton? Or by their own wishes? Was there some symbiotic energy these men had felt? On the far side rose the jagged mountain peaks. When Marianne had first arrived in this area at the end of the war, a freshly mounded pile of earth ran alongside this river. As she rode into Mommsen with Karsten Kellerman for the first time, she saw men and women scrabbling around on its banks, digging. "What are they doing?" she had asked.
"Looking for their people," he had answered, his eyes inscrutable.
This was the grave of hundreds of marchers, he explained. The end point for those wretched collections of prisoners driven west from concentration camps. Why? For what reasons were they marched? At that point, the war was as good as over. Everyone knew. But still the SS had marched those prisoners until they dropped from exhaustion and then shot them when they fell. So the dead had lain here until the townspeople buried them, under this pile of earth. And after a capitulation, some small number of brothers and fathers and friends and cousins returned to look for their loved ones. Marianne would never forget that. But the townspeople went about their business as if it had never happened. They fished and washed in the river and walked alongside it in the evenings. No one spoke of the prisoners they had watched stumble and die along its banks. No one erected a marker over their bones. At Mommsen station, Marianne got off. She had steeled herself for the encounter. But now that she was actually here, her hands were cold and clammy and her face felt hot. Better to be quick and done with it. The children would wonder where she was, and left to their own devices, they would certainly forget their studies. Fritz would get into trouble. Benita was as good as another child when it came to discipline. Marianne had intended to confide her plan to Anya, but something had stopped her. Anya had seemed surprised to learn of Benita's affair, but not shocked. It was clear she did not share Marianne's moral outrage. And why should she? She had never known Connie, and from what Marianne could discern, her own husband's life as a resistor remained opaque. Anya was deeply silent on the subject. Marianne suspected marital tragedies that went beyond the man's death. And it was her philosophy not to disturb them. What good was opening a wound that had sealed itself shut? So she let it be, though deep down, she was disappointed by Anya's indifference. Marriage to Kellerman had put distance between them. But unlike Franz Müller, Karsten Kellerman was a good man, at least. In the month since Benita had announced her engagement, a stilted, awkward air had settled over their flat. Marianne and Benita skirted each other and exchanged cool, polite conversation only when necessary. Fortunately, the children were too absorbed in their own activities to notice the chill. Martin and Fritz would soon depart for the boarding school Katharina and Elisabeth attended, and they were busy roaming the hills and fields around Tollingen, enjoying their summer holiday. But this silence in their flat could not go on forever. Even in her anger, Marianne loved her friend. Benita needed protection. She was easy prey, so fragile and romantic and readily swayed. For all Marianne knew, Müller might harbor a false sense of her fortune and believe her to be rich. After all, when he'd met her, she'd lived in a castle. And who knew what his debts were, or his prospects? It was easy to find the shop where Herr Müller worked. There was only one coffin maker in Mommsen. It sat on the first floor of a hulking, coal-smoke-stained building, still pocked with bullet holes. In the final days of the war, the local Hitler Youth and Home Guard had put up a fierce, irrational fight, losing countless lives, destroying buildings and bridges, and the mad captain in charge of this motley group was now a town councilman. Mommsen was as bad as Erlenheim, in Marianne's view. To the left of the shop, Marianne found a doorway with a list of names. Müller, one read. So he lived here, too. Marianne could not imagine Benita calling this home. She was a woman who lived for creature comforts and pretty dresses. It bolstered Marianne's sense of rightness to think that she was sparing her friend from such a fate. A little girl opened the door when Marianne knocked. Pale, dark-haired and unusually slim, with wide, wary eyes.
"Can I help you?" the girl asked. "Is this the shop of Franz Müller?" Marianne asked.
The girl nodded. She looked about Martin's age.
"Would you like to come in?" she asked.
"Papa!"
she called into the shop. Marianne was taken aback. So the man had a daughter. It rendered him less monstrous. The door opened into a gloomy alcove, and from somewhere inside, she heard the grating of a saw, which at this moment knocked off.
"Clotilde!"
came a man's voice, and heavy footfalls across the floor. And then Franz Müller stood at the entrance. In the flesh, his face looked dismayingly ordinary, free of the darkness Marianne had attached to it in her mind's eye.
"You can invite our visitor in,"
he began, and then broke off, recognizing Marianne.
"Frau von Lingenfels,"
he said in surprise.
"Come in."
He held open the door.
"Can I offer you something? We don't have much here, but a cup of tea. Some biscuits."
"That's all right," Marianne said. Just a moment of your time.
Ah, he nodded. Clotilde, will you leave us? You can go upstairs and see if Grosspapa needs help.
The girl's dark eyes passed from her father to Marianne with curiosity. Then she grabbed her coat off a hook.
When shall I come back?
I will come get you, Franz said. Go on, but say goodbye to Frau von Lingenfels first.
Goodbye, the girl said. Please come again.
It seemed such a curious thing to say. Come again to a coffin shop? Did they have many repeat visitors? Or had she mistaken Marianne for a friend? The girl's innocence was disarming. Marianne watched as her narrow back disappeared. Marianne followed Herr Müller into the shop. It was a long, narrow place, with coffins lining one wall, and the planks and boards they were made of stacked high on the other. So much wood and so many supplies for preserving the dead. It was an ugly business. In the corner was a modest table and four chairs. Perhaps this was where Herr Müller sat to sell his wares to vulnerable, grief-stricken clients. This, too, shored up her resolve. He pulled a chair out for her and sat down.
Herr Müller, Marianne began. I won't waste your time. You are a busy man, I can see. I wanted, however, to tell you that Benita has informed me of your plans.
She made an effort not to look away. In all the hopeless meetings with Nazi officials that she had conducted when Albrecht was in prison, she had learned how to return a gaze.
A plan? He asked.
Your plan to marry?
She let the word sit between them.
And I would like you to know that I am against it.
Oh.
The man looked stricken.
Benita's first husband was my good friend, she continued. A very dear friend, and a man of great character. He gave his life fighting against Hitler and the Nazis, and I don't believe it is right that his widow, and more importantly, his son, be joined.
She hesitated, gathering courage.
To a man with your past.
Outside, a wagon clattered down the street. But in the room full of coffins, Herr Müller mounted no defense. He had shockingly blue eyes. Marianne had forgotten this.
Does Benita know you're here?
He asked finally.
No.
Marianne swallowed.
Ah.
He nodded. Marianne waited for an outburst of indignation. She had prepared for this. But still he said nothing.
I hope to keep this conversation between us,
she said into the silence.
I promised her husband before he died that I would look out for her, and that I would look out for his son.
I understand.
Herr Müller nodded.
You understand?
Marianne repeated. The man lifted his eyes.
I love Benita, he said. She is a good woman, and she deserves a good life. And I...
He paused.
I wish it were different. I wish my life had not been as it was.
His blue eyes flashed at hers.
And I am deeply sorry for the loss of your husband and hers. They were brave men.
Marianne stared at him. To her horror, she felt that she was going to cry. Or worse, that she was about to snort and sob and explode with all the ungraceful, unholy sadness that she had locked up inside her. And once she started, she would never stop. She could not let this happen. So she sat straight as an arrow and focused on the coffins, the dark knots of pine and the striping of oak, the gleam of the hinges. Silence wailed around them. This time not awkward, but necessary. Like a cocoon. From upstairs came the sounds of footsteps, muffled voices, the sweet chirp of the girl and the lower, grumpier tone of the grandfather, whoever he was. Marianne held on to these like a lifeline, trying to make out the words of their conversation. The effort calmed her. The hard knot in her throat dissipated. With as much dignity as possible, she rose. Herr Müller followed, jumping to pull back her chair. When they arrived at the threshold, he bowed.
"I will consider your words," he said.
"Thank you,"
Marianne managed, ducking her head. When she was around the corner, she stopped, her chest heaving. She had intended to mention the Russian, Müller's time in the East, and the fact of Benita's innocence, her trust, her naivete. What had happened? Somehow, Müller's lack of argument had rendered her preparations irrelevant. She had gotten what she wanted.
"Albrecht," she called out in her mind. "I did what was right, didn't I?"
But it was almost as if she were talking to herself. Chapter 22. Tollingen, July 1950. Benita was meeting Franz to talk about the future. She had not seen him since their engagement. First, Clotilde had been sick, then his father, and then work had been too busy. Too many dead people, Benita joked in a moment of lightness. But she had finally managed to corral him. Their marriage plans would need to be accelerated. Marianne's response to their news was even worse than Benita had imagined, and she hated living with her in this new, uncomfortable silence. Every day was like a punishment. And for what? Loving a man Marianne did not approve of? It was insulting, and worse, condescending, as if she had no right to her own future. Benita owed Marianne gratitude for finding Martin when she had given him up for dead. And for that, she would be forever grateful. But she did not owe Marianne the rest of her life. She waited for Franz at Bemelmann's Café in a state of agitation, clicking the spoon in her cup of coffee. Usually, Bemelmann's made Benita happy. It was new, for one thing, and she liked new. She liked the high gleaming windows and chic metal tabletops. She liked the sweetened cream and a selection of modern torts with their bright out-of-season fruits and glossy layers of gelatin. Benita held no reverence for anything old or historic. History was horrible, a long, sloppy tale of grief. It swished destructively behind the present, toppling everyone's own personal understanding of the past. It was, in part, why she felt such an urgent need to remarry. For Marianne, history came above all else. For Benita, it was death. From the moment Franz walked in, though, Benita knew something was not right. His usually calm, placid face was edged with worry, and he looked as though he had not slept in weeks.
"Franzl,"
she said, wrinkling her brow.
"What is it? You look like a man who has swallowed a monster."
He shook his head and sat across from her.
"It isn't right,"
were the first words from his mouth. Not "hello" or "how are you" or "you look beautiful." The rudeness was utterly unlike him.
"What isn't?"
she asked. Franz looked out the window at the drizzle.
"I can't marry you, Benita."
Benita pretended that she had not heard him.
"You can't what?"
she asked. On the street, a group of jabbering teenage girls scuttled past.
"I can't marry you, Benita. It wouldn't be right."
For Benita, the whole world lurched.
"Right?"
she managed to ask.
"For who?"
"For you," Franz sighed. "For Martin. You deserve better."
"Better than what? Is this about the flat?"
The thought flooded her with relief, and she grasped it like a lifeline.
"I don't care about the flat. We will move someday, and in the meantime, we can find a place for your father. A room in the house on the corner, maybe, or..."
"I don't mean that,"
Franz interjected, his voice harsh. Benita sat back.
"You are the wife of a resister. You deserve a man who has done better with his life."
Benita stiffened. This was not a term Benita had ever used. Resister.
referring to Connie and Albrecht and the others. It was Marianne's word.
"Why do you say this?"
she asked, reaching across the table for his hand.
"Did Marianne say something to you? Did she come here?"
Franz looked away, and his voice was tired.
"It's the truth."
"According to who?"
Benita demanded.
"According to Marianne. She came here, didn't she? She talked to you. Look me in the eye and tell me she didn't."
"This is not about Marianne,"
Franz said.
"It doesn't matter what she did."
"How dare she? She came here and talked to you behind my back, as if I were a child. Smaller than a child, a toy. Something to move around as she likes. She never liked you."
She lowered her voice to something like a hiss.
"She blames you for that dead Russian in the woods. And you know what? I would kill him again if I had to. Just to show her it was me who did it."
"Benita."
"It's true, Franz. You know that. She doesn't understand. She sees everything through her principles and ideas. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what she thinks. What about you? Aren't you happy when we are together? And don't I make you happy?"
She paused.
"Connie is dead."
It came out harshly, catching in her throat. She was aware that her voice had risen, but didn't care. Let all the sheep-like patrons of Bemelmans be shocked. Let them whisper and avert their eyes.
"But we are alive, and we have suffered too. Don't we deserve this happiness?"
"Deserve?"
Franz asked quietly, his eyes remote.
"I don't deserve anything, Benita."
"You had to leave your family. You had to march into the East and nearly starve and freeze, and God knows what else. And now it's over."
"The war is over.
And finally we can begin something new."
"Stop," Franz commanded. "You can't say this. Your husband, Marianne's husband, they died for something they knew was right. And the rest of us followed along, did as we were told, and looked away. I can't erase that. I can't just begin again."
"Why not? Is there any other choice?"
Dishes clinked and voices murmured around them. The cash register chimed. Someone laughed.
"There are always choices." Franz looked at her. "I can choose to let you go. You can begin a new life."
"But I don't want to begin a new life."
Benita was crying now.
"Not without you. I don't care what you did. It doesn't matter. I would love you if you were Hitler himself."
Franz stared at her, and his face was a stranger's.
"You have no shame, Benita," he said finally. "And for me, shame is the only right way to live."
Benita sat back. This was the end, her own stupid words repeated in her head. In the silence, Benita could see the future. No pleasant, homey flat with flowers in the window and a place for Clotilde and Martin to study. No wide, soft bed to sleep in. No lovemaking. No new, ordinary, from-scratch life full of simple things like cooking and marketing and Sunday walks along the river. No mornings of sunshine and coffee and growing old together. For Franz, there was only the motion of these things. His soul was already in hell. It was not Marianne who had come between them, but the past. Chapter 23. Mommsen, August 1950. When Anya's water broke, the convent hospital in Erenheim was still under construction, so Karsten drove her to the American military hospital outside of Mommsen. It was nearly empty. And as soon as he handed her off to the nurses, he turned around and drove home. Then Anya could moan and clutch her belly and stop gritting her teeth. The nurses were kind, albeit alarmed. They were young American girls trained to bind wounds and dress amputations, not deliver babies. The doctor arrived and proclaimed it was too late to induce the twilight sleep, and the nurses squeezed her hands and smoothed her forehead in terrified support. But Anya was not concerned. She had already delivered two babies without such interventions.
She knew only that she wanted to return home as quickly as possible. She had secrets to keep. Improbably, she had managed to keep Rainer hidden, like some awful Rapunzel he was locked in the castle. Only he was free to come and go as he pleased. From the moment Anya saw him, she had understood what he wanted. It was not exposure or revenge. For all his anger and despair, he did not wish to destroy the life she had created for their sons. He wanted to see his boys. He was deathly ill, and like a shamed and beaten animal, he was looking for a safe place to die. Berg Lingenfels was closed down. Last fall, Karsten had boarded the windows as she and Marianne had covered what little furniture remained. They had planned to reopen it this summer, but then had not. Marianne was busy with her new project, sorting Albrecht's papers, and traveling a great deal. And last year, the local teenagers had used the empty castle to get into trouble. It was better to keep it shut up. There were only mice and swallows nesting in the stone walls, water rats and frogs burrowing into the chinks of the moat. No one went there except for Wolfgang, whom Karsten had tasked with checking on it from time to time. Anya had been forced to involve her boys in their father's return, ever dutiful but simmering with resentment. They had half walked, half carried Rainer up the hill from the Kellermann farm. Wolfgang had arranged a straw pallet in the castle's kitchen, along with a supply of water to drink. Anselm brought him a plate of food every night. He barely ate. Presumably, while she lay here giving birth to this new baby, her boys tended to their father, locked in some weird reversal with the man who had never cared for them. Anya's contractions sped forward until the pain was as constant as her heartbeat, rhythmic and all-consuming. It obliterated worry. She was almost grateful. Rainer would be discovered or not. Her boys would tend to him or leave him for the ravens. Their life would explode or continue on the trajectory she had wrestled it into. There was nothing she could do. The baby came fast. In 30 violent minutes, Anya pushed her out. Even 4 weeks early, she was as plump and smooth-faced as an Eskimo. With her round, dark eyes, she regarded the world impassively and then fell asleep. This was apparently what a child of Karsten's was like. Or maybe this was simply a baby of peacetime. Satisfied, round-cheeked, and enigmatic. Swaddled in U.S. Army-issue blankets, she seemed to belong to some promising international future rather than a defeated Germany. Anya handed her to the nurse and attempted to rise to her feet.
"No, no," the nurse protested in alarm. "Rest now, because you'll need your strength when you go home."
What did she know?
The nurses plied her with glasses of lukewarm water and sleeping pills. Karsten would not return for her until morning, anyway. Anya did not want to see the baby, so she took the pills they offered and drifted in and out of a thick, dreamless sleep, waking now and then to stare through the window at the courtyard, the bleached white paths across the grass like a crisscross of bones. The next morning, she woke to find Benita sitting at the foot of her bed. It took Anya a moment to remember where she was.
"Benita," she managed to say. "Did you come to see me?"
The idea seemed incredible. She had not seen Benita for so long, possibly not since the wedding.
"Why else? I went to the farm yesterday and heard the news."
Benita did not look well. Anya could see this. She did not have her usual rosy cheeks and neatly arranged hair. She was wearing a shabby brown cardigan, and there were dark circles under her eyes.
"Is everything all right?"
Anya began, but a nurse appeared, holding the baby. Her baby. The idea was still unaccustomed. Anya regarded the swaddled creature and felt nothing.
"There she is,"
Benita exclaimed. For a moment, enthusiasm restored her beauty. She was the sort of woman who lit up in the presence of an infant. Her love of Martin had always made Anya feel sorry for her own sons. Both loved so much less lavishly.
"Can I hold her, please?"
Benita asked. Anya nodded. The nurse laid the baby in Benita's arms.
"You're so lucky,"
she said, her eyes filling. She's beautiful, and you can enjoy her. No wars and bombs to protect her from. And all this,
she hesitated, then landed on the word,
safety. Do you know, when Martin was a baby, I was so worried he would be crushed in a bombing that I turned our ice box into a crib. I thought it would save him if the ceiling caved in.
As if an ice box would have protected him. She shifted the baby, who made a faint purring sound.
I was such a child.
We were all children, Anya sighed.
I didn't intend to disrespect Connie, you know,
Benita announced with sudden ferocity.
If I had married Herr Müller, it would not have harmed Connie's memory.
If you had? Anya repeated.
We were engaged. Benita sat back. I thought Marianne told you.
She looked at the ceiling and tears slid down her cheeks.
How seamlessly, she cried, as if she went through life filled to the brim.
Anya shook her head. Marianne didn't approve. It required no more explanation. Benita's will had never been a match for Marianne's.
So you have decided not to?
Anya ventured.
Decided?
Benita snapped and stood up, still holding the baby. She went to the window and then turned back.
I decided nothing, but Marianne told Franz she was against it. And he... It doesn't matter. I was stupid to imagine I could be happy again. It's not why I came, anyway.
She adjusted the baby and wiped her tears with the back of her hand.
I came to say goodbye. After we take the boys to Salem, I am going home to Frühlinghausen.
To Frühlinghausen?
Anya repeated. This surprised her as much as anything else Benita had said.
To take care of your sister.
Benita tried to smile at the baby in her arms.
It's where I belong.
Anya stared. Benita had always hated the town where she was born.
What does Marianne say about this?
She doesn't know.
Anya regarded this woman she knew so well and yet not at all. Their lives had become entwined during such a strange time, without context, severed from the past, before the future. A time dictated by basic needs. What did they really know of each other?
Are you sure?
She asked, the words sounding obtuse even to her own ears. The baby's little hand clasped and unclasped against Benita's neck.
Nothing is sure, is it?
Benita said almost dreamily.
That's what Marianne doesn't understand.
The baby began to cry.
Here.
Benita bent and placed her in Anya's arms. The nurse appeared in the doorway.
Do you want to feed her, Frau Kellermann? Or should I give her the bottle?
Feed her,
Benita said to Anya with sudden surprising authority.
Take care of her. That is the most important thing. Auf Wiedersehen.
She leaned down to kiss Anya's cheek.
Mach's gut,
Anya said and caught her hand. Make it good, an old expression her mother had used.
You too.
Benita squeezed her fingers and brought them to her lips, and then she was gone.
Does the baby have a name yet?
The young nurse asked after Benita left. Anya began to shake her head no.
Then a name occurred to her,
first as a joke, almost a joke,
and then real.
A name like a talisman. The name of the strongest, stubbornest, most difficult and wisest woman she knew.
Marianne, she said. Her name is Marianne.
The nurse smiled.
Marianne,
she repeated in her American accent.
Pretty.
She looked down at the baby, who had latched onto Anya's breast hungrily.
Be a good girl, little Marianne.
Chapter 24. Zalem Castle, September 1950. The day the boys were scheduled to start Zalem Castle boarding school was clear and crisp and sharp-edged in a way that was unusual for the region, which was known for its soft, moist air and bouts of low pressure, blamed for headaches and illnesses and despair. A brisk autumn wind blew off the Alps, scattering sunlight across Lake Constance, so it looked like an audience of people clapping hands. Marianne had hired a driver for the trip.
She sat in the front, straight-backed, long-necked, craning around every so often to remind the children of a piece of history or point out a landmark, and sitting in the back, sandwiched between Martin and the door. Benita hated her.
"You think you know so much," she wanted to say. "But you know nothing. You have never even been in love."
It was something Benita understood after all these years of living together. Marianne, who had once seemed so intimidatingly wise, was in fact ignorant. She was her own kind of dreamer, a blind mathematician skating along the thin surface of life, believing in the saving power of logic, reason, and information, overlooking the whole murky expanse of feeling and animal instinct that was the real driver of human behavior, the real author of history. Since that awful day when Benita returned to their flat from Bemelmann's, Marianne had several times attempted something like an apology.
"You know, if you would like, I could go back to Herr Müller and tell him I had no right to speak as I did,"
Marianne had said one evening when Benita staggered blearily out of her room at supper time. Emerging for the first time that day, Benita only stared. Did the woman really believe it was so simple? That a few well-chosen words could make everything right? Or was this simply her shrewd play for forgiveness, a way to exonerate herself without ceding the territory she had won?
"No,"
Benita had replied. Unlike Marianne, she understood that what had happened was not caused, but exposed by the other woman's interference. There was a tight black cave where Franz Müller's heart, or something more than his heart, his personhood, should be. He had lost it in the war, and there was no getting it back. It was only a careful sidestep around the place it had once lived, a dance of ignorance that she had mastered without even knowing it. And there was no going back now. Marianne was elated by the fact that finally all their children, Martin included, would be settled at the fine German boarding school that Albrecht and Connie and their fathers before them had attended. Zellum was a school remarkably untarnished by affiliation with the Nazis, attended by the aristocracy, founded by a Jew. Marianne believed anything could be solved by a good education. "Look at the vast ignorance of the Nazis," she liked to exclaim. If only they had understood music and art. If they had read Kant and Goethe and listened to Mozart instead of burning books, the world might have been spared. Benita understood but did not agree. Look at that hate-mongering huckster Goebbels. He was a doctor of philosophy. In the back of the car, Fritz and Katharina argued fiercely. Elisabeth rested her head against the window and feigned an air of hassled sophistication. Martin, absorbing his mother's despair, was silent. For his sake, Benita tried to rouse herself.
"Do you suppose they'll give you a hot supper tonight?" "It's never a hot supper on the first night,"
Elisabeth informed them, rousing herself enough to answer.
"Dried fish, smoked ham, brown bread."
She wrinkled her nose.
"I hope you aren't too hungry."
As they rounded the final bend in the road, Zellum Castle sprang into view, its angular red roofs and white walls rising from the fields like an elegant mini-city. Fritz let out a whoop, and Elisabeth a theatrical sigh of relief.
"Aha!"
Marianne turned around and beamed.
"You see, Martin? Isn't it beautiful?"
Martin nodded, but his face remained somber.
"Welcome,"
Marianne said grandly, turning to face forward again,
"to your new home."
Benita placed her hand on her son's leg and squeezed. But being a young man now, he moved it away. At the castle entrance, there was a throng of students, attendants, prefects, and other foreboding-looking officials giving orders. Fine pieces of luggage, instrument cases, and steamer trunks were piled in small mountains. The von Lingenfelses were immediately absorbed into the scene. Elisabeth and Katharina calling out to friends, Marianne greeting teachers. Even Fritz appeared at home, scrambling toward some coveted position in the crush. Martin and Benita alone stood beside the car.
"Come along, come along,"
Marianne strode over, seeing their inaction.
"The bellboys will unload.
Benita and Martin followed her through the sea of bright young people, a whole